Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
I don't understand the concept of going through all of your developmental years, never spending, let alone a majority, even a minority of your time focused on purpose and what it is that you want to be. Not necessarily your occupation, just what is it that you want out of life? Like, who are you as a person? It scares me because I think that we're developing a society of people that are completely apathetic towards their own lives. I think that you're going to start to see, I mean, we've already seen circumstances where people are no longer getting as involved politically. They're no longer getting as involved in like their communities or social organizations. And they don't question anymore the things that it is that they're doing. They're doing kind of like the initial goals of education, which is they're just obeying the person at the top. I just can't understand how someone could actually walk into a classroom and say, my work is more important than your purpose of being a person.
Well, first of all, this speaks to why I named the show School Sucks.
Well, I was walking down the high road, and this guy stops me. He just got in from New Zealand, and he was looking for mushy bees. I said, no. Got them around here. I said, but we do got.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today's Friday. You're going to be hearing this on Monday, February 11th, or it is a podcast anytime after that. If you are listening to this and it has not yet reached February 11th, something really strange is happening. Please notify me immediately. The show is not out yet. But I'm going to pretend that right now is Monday and tell you that I sent out an email to thousands of people. And if you're not on our email list, please go to schoolsucksproject.com. There is a form right at the top of the page there. If you sign up, I will send you a 5-day mini course on building a morning routine. Now, Brett, have you changed your morning routine since you made that? Yes. Have you simplified it? Indeed. Do you only do 5 things now? Of course. It just goes over several of the things that I found to be really helpful in getting my day started. But of course, it also promotes flexibility and adaptability. Productivity is an ongoing pursuit. It needs to change all the time. Andrew and I actually talk about that in the most recent episode of the very positively reviewed subscriber-only show called The Discomfort Zone. When you go to the website to join the email list, you could also check out the membership tab in the menu, and you can see how to get involved in all of that. Season 2, Meeting 1, is due out on Tuesday the 12th. But yeah, this is an ever-evolving process, and I still stand by the principles in the Tiny course. So if that's the kind of thing you think might be helpful for you, go to the website, sign up, and it will start arriving in your email inbox in the next couple of days. Step 1, clean your room! You know? The reason why I sent out the email, and I posted this on Facebook and Instagram as well, looking for your input on the next evolution of School Sucks Project. Starting this spring, we are going to be hosting virtual summits. I see these as the next step, a new challenge, a new way to provide value to the School Sucks listenership. You know, at this point, I wake up in the morning, I go to podomatic.com, I look at the rankings for educational podcasts, I see School Sucks is number 1, and I yawn. Time for something new, I say. But on the other hand, I also think that, you know, I'm a man over 40 running a business with the word sucks in it. And sure, in some industries that works and is appropriate, but I am constantly aware of the fact that it is hard to be taken seriously if the industry is education. And I really want to start building something that can expand beyond, that can outgrow the School Sucks podcast. Even though at first, School Sucks will be the soil that this new thing grows in. I also like the possibility of capturing the spirit, the interactive feel of an event. I really like the social aspect of the events that I did over the last couple of years with Thaddeus Russell. And I'd like to make that experience accessible to more people, but it is very cost prohibitive. But I think I've actually come up with a pretty good solution here. This spring, we're going to begin doing virtual summits. And I encourage people to think of a virtual summit as kind of a combination of a course and an event. Now, it'd be great to do events all the time, but for attendees, events can get pretty expensive. I know this firsthand from hosting and attending events. Plane tickets, hotels, food. A virtual event eliminates all of these costs. So each virtual summit will run for 2 or 3 days for a period of probably like 8 hours, 5 to 8 hours a day. And we'll bring together 10 to 15 people to present on a specific skill or a knowledge area. There will be several interactive or questions and answer sessions between the presentations. My aim is to do 3 of these summits in 2019 and 5 in 2020. The completed summits will be collected into a product library at schoolsucksproject.com that will eventually grow to synthesize our most valuable work. I've divided our entire body of work at School Sucks into 4 main categories, and each main category has 4 subcategories. The first category is problems, which is, you know, have you heard about how school sucks? So that includes subcategories like the history of public schooling, the dumbing down of America, the politics of public school, the crisis in higher education. For the summits, I want to focus on solutions categories. So the first one is critical thinking, things like the trivium method, logic and logical fallacies, learning tools, media literacy. Another one of our main categories is personal development. So that's self-knowledge, things like ACEs, self-esteem, like the 6 pillars, self-optimization, which is, you know, everything from productivity to health and fitness to time management, and self-liberation, which is really focused on entrepreneurship. Our last solution is real-world learning, which includes the principles of self-directed learning, home education and unschooling, learning communities and alternative schools, and un-college, paths around college, apprenticeships. You might notice we've been focusing a lot of our attention there lately when it comes to the content. So a lot of the podcasting that I've been doing is bulking up these areas that I feel like we're lacking, or I feel like we don't have content that is current. We've been covering all these things for a decade at this point, but just doing some updates. So of all those categories, I would like people to think in terms of the personal development, the critical thinking, and the alternative education, the real world learning category. And today's topic of discussion fits into that last category as well. Back when I started doing the show almost 10 years ago, I quickly encountered many, many people who all would say some version of, I like your message, I agree with what you're saying, I cannot take my kids out of public school, or I cannot homeschool / unschool. And, you know, there was a variety of reasons. But even as, you know, the young, angry, absolutist, purist dipstick of a guy that I was, I still tried to understand everybody's story. I heard more of these stories when I started doing Free Talk Live as a regular host in 2014. But long before that, I realized school survival had to be a part of the conversation here. And even if I didn't realize this right from the outset of School Sucks back in 2009, it is alienating to suggest that there is only one method of education that is acceptable. And over the years, I've also missed an opportunity to have more conversations with people who work inside the system who understand that school is something in its current form to be survived, and they are working to insert ideas and practices to make it more survivable for the 90%+ of American children who are stuck there. And there's an opportunity in those conversations. And for too long, that was a group of people that I ignored. Or if I did not ignore them, I approached them in some kind of unconstructive way. Now, I did say in the very first episode of School Sucks, maybe some of you might not have even been born then, that I have no interest in school reform. I stood in principle against the very idea. Personally, I still don't, as far as directing any of my own time or energy into it. But I didn't get, just from where I stood, how you can engage in that effort without feeling small and powerless. And if I had reached out to more people who were trying to do that, there would have been some understanding to gain, at least. Because I'm fully aware that the most serious and impactful conversations about schooling versus education, the future of education, what education really means, not going on in the forums at schoolsucksproject.com. In fact, nothing is going on there. Forums aren't a thing anymore. And along with that realization, and my guest today and his organization actually was helpful in this realization, the act of turning up your nose at school reform efforts doesn't really bring any rewards for anyone. And today's conversation deals with applying some of the strategies and practices that home educators and unschoolers would be very happy with, very comfortable with, to the public school setting as it exists right now. To me, this seems like an impossible proposition. But I recently became aware of the Human Restoration Project, a group of teachers working together engaged in this effort, and I wanted to learn more about it. My guest today, Chris McNutt, is one of the founders of the Human Restoration Project. He and I agree on many things, and we disagree on many things. And this is definitely a conversation that's outside of my comfort zone. I mean, most of the people that I have on the show are people that I agree with on almost everything, and I would definitely like to have more variety in guests. And that being said, some of you will listen to this and say, Brett, you guys didn't fight enough. I'm thinking about this as an introduction to an ongoing conversation with Chris and perhaps other members of the Human Restoration Project. And of course, I'd love your input on where we could go next. There's going to be lots of pathways revealed in today's conversation. And I felt like this was a really important door to open. There's a great learning opportunity here. I hope you find today's show valuable. I look forward to your feedback. Thank you for listening and take care.
So anyway, I told him I was in a band. He said, oh yeah, I'm back. What's the music like?
Hi, Chris.
Hey.
Thank you so much for alerting me to what you guys are doing. Obviously, there's going to be lots of overlap, lots of places where we agree. But there's also, you know, as far as a somewhat unified vision for what we'd like to see for students and young people, we came from different places. There's probably a little bit of disagreement, too. So I see this being like an ongoing conversation. And I was hoping we could treat today's show kind of like an introduction, introducing my audience to the Human Restoration Project. And the Human Restoration Project also has a podcast in its third season, right, called Things mm-hmm. Fall Apart?
Correct. Yep.
What's that title mean?
Things Fall Apart came from the book by Chinua Achebe, which is all about like colonizing human beings. And one of my teacher friends who co-founded Human Restoration Project with me essentially was teaching that to one of his classes very traditionally and came to the realization that he was basically colonizing his kids by teaching a book about colonization. Mm. So we wanted the title of the podcast to reflect that idea of both things falling apart quite literally, as in things fall apart in the classroom, as well as kind of getting against that idea of imperialism in the classroom.
Gotcha. So what is the Human Restoration Project, which you guys founded at the beginning of last year?
So essentially what it is it's a group of progressive educators sharing their thoughts on things that aren't always talking about or spoken about, but are, you know, just kind of things that might upset a few people, maybe a little bit more rebellious. So it's a blog, it's a podcast. We have a collection of research and resources that back us up, as well as we spread everything for free. So for someone who's seeking something different in the education system, they could come to our website and learn more about things like gradeless learning or talking about purpose building in schools or just doing things different than the norm.
Right. Now, progressive is a word that might, just by itself, might terrify some of the people in my audience. So what is progressive education?
Sure. So the way I think about it, like this, at least in comparison to School Sucks, and I don't want to make any assumptions. When I think of School Sucks in your podcast audience, I would assume that's mostly libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, progressive education, true progressive education, like John Dewey and Paulo Freire and Henry Guru, is left libertarian. It's a ideology rooted in like the 60s and 70s, especially, that grew out of the movement for wanting more freedom in education by still having that social collectivism that you typically find on the left in terms of equitable society. So many of the things that we agree on, which are like anti-authoritarianism in schools, is heavily reflected. But progressive education tends to take the form of instilling some kind of sense of community amongst its students. So elements of progressive education include critical pedagogy, so involving students in the conversation, actually letting them have an authentic voice and sharing their thoughts and feelings and actually having those things matter to the point that they actually would be in charge would be the end game goal. Making sure that creativity is the cornerstone of what you're doing and purpose finding. So getting away from the core subject areas and moving more towards something that's mostly focused on the individual or the community, as well as just ensuring that you're getting away from the standardization that exists right now. So instead of focusing more on, you know, everyone's doing the exact same thing at all times, which is rooted from, you know, the 1800s.
Right.
Instead, we're more focused on what are ways that we can innovate and do things for, at least in my opinion, the soul. Sometimes progressive education tends to get focused too much on like Tony Wagner and Ted Dintersmith, which I love their work, but it tends to focus more on how to get a job, at least in like the 1900 sense of progressive education. It's more focused on fulfilling humans and what they are, hence the Human Restoration Project, which I think leads to a job, but it's more to it than for monetary gain.
Gotcha. So if we could say that the three pillars are passion, like discovering what you're passionate about and pursuing it, embracing creativity and having an environment where that is possible, where that is fostered and where that is encouraged. Yep. And breaking away from the standardization. I mean, my introduction to the problem of school was sitting in a graduate classroom 15 years ago, listening to active public school teachers complain about the implementation of No Child Left Behind. And sure. Obviously, you know, standardization, the system we understand was set up over 150 years ago in this country to standardize a population, to put them into anti-individualism forge in many ways. Mm-hmm. And it still has artifacts of that today. So I think that if those are the three pillars of progressive education, I would agree. It's interesting what you said about you know, forming people to, or like setting people up to get a job. Are you familiar with Killer Mike?
Have
you seen his special on Netflix?
I did watch it. Yeah.
Okay. What did you think of that? Because I actually just watched that on my lunch break today. And I was like, is this guy for, like, I love Killer Mike, but I was like, is he for real? Is this parody? Because I know he's a supporter of the system, but just for people who haven't seen his Netflix show, Trigger Warning, episode 2 is about school. He is telling people it is irresponsible and maybe even ridiculous to let kids believe in their dreams, and school should just be through and through vocational training.
So let me ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be?
A pediatrician.
A pediatrician. Yes,
I'm going to be a scientist, and I'll try to find the cure for cancer. And,
and.
I'm going to make a rocket that can go into the sun.
What are you going to be when you grow up?
A president, and I will make,
You want to be a president? Yes, Mason.
I forgot to tell you, I'm going to be a scientist, remember?
Yes.
And I'm going to make this potion that will make my whole family superheroes.
You owe your parents not to dream big. You know, you owe it to your parents to dream practical and start making money as soon as you can. Like, you're not going to be able to be president. Do you guys know what a carpenter is?
Yeah. Yes. My dad worked for a carpenter, and now he has his own business.
Let's talk about her dad now. Her dad builds stuff for other people. Her dad's going to always have a job. Put your hands down. That's what the world does to you. You have your hands up like, I have hope. I have dreams. Look at me. And the world says, we're not interested. But When the world says, I need a cabinet, put your hands back up. That's when you say, I'm right here. So we're going to call a guy in here. His name's Tobin. He's a nice guy. And he's going to show us how to do stuff.
I talked to some children this morning. Okay. Those six kids.
I told these kids, we're going to forget everything we learned in school. Now you got to learn how to poster, lay carpet, wood flooring.
But where would kids learn how to think?
I don't think school teaches us to think. I think school, like prison, teaches you to obey.
What's the age? So you're saying, like, when kids are, like, kinder first, let's start.
I tell my kids as early as five. Like, I don't believe in your dream. It's whack, you know?
Oh, okay.
Do you think this program would work for children?
No. No. I think that what you're saying, you know, it sounds good in theory, but I don't think that your idea would work for my children. But for adults, I think that we do need those kind of programs. We need vocational programs where they can take up a trade. So just focus on them.
I will pick up my bucket.
Okay.
And I will take it to the adults, and I will hope they will appreciate my genius.
Maybe Principal Robin was right. These kids wouldn't be able to make a livable wage laying flooring at their age. So I hit the streets of Atlanta to find some unemployed adults willing to speak to me about learning trades.
So he comes up with this, it's kind of a hammy bit on the show, but a way to get people a vocational education. But yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, so I personally thought it was satire, just given right. the fact that Killer Mike, I mean, he campaigned with Bernie Sanders.
Right.
So I just don't really think that he would be the kind of person to say, like, let's completely transition to vocational ed. However, I think some of the elements of what he's talking about made sense, at least towards the beginning. So in the episode, it starts off with talking about how essentially school, I mean, school sucks. I guess that's I think he actually says fuck school is his exact yep. verbiage. Mm-hmm. But I get that point. The point where he lost me, which again, I think was satire, was the point where he was saying, well, the way that we're going to teach these skills that people should know is by making it sexy, quite literally,
right.
Which in my opinion is basically what Teach Like a Champion does. Or Teach Like a Pirate or any of like those, you know, things that people sell at Barnes & Noble. So taking these ideas that already exist, because vocational ed's been promoted now for years as an option in many places, and just making it better, like teaching it better. In my opinion, where that the loss is there is that no one's asking the kid what it is they want to do and actually following through on it. It's still like, you need to do this because this is a job that you could get, or you need to do this because you aren't going to be able to do this. But no one's asking the kid, like, what is it that you want to do, and just doing that.
Right. Absolutely. To circle back to the way we present on School Sucks, I would say that my original influences were out of that radical school reform movement of the 1960s that you mentioned. I think the first book that I sat down and read was Jonathan Kozol, The Night is Dark and I'm Far mm-hmm. From Home. So he was sort of an outside part of that movement for sure. Paulo Freire did not come to my attention until 2017, actually, and I wasn't even looking for school criticism or school reform. I was researching critical theory. So that was my entry point. And then there were more conservative influences like Sam Blumenfeld, who was a part of the mm-hmm. Reagan administration, was an arch enemy of John Dewey, John Taylor Gatto, who is mm-hmm. certainly more libertarian leaning. Also not a fan of John Dewey. And then, you know, this was all happening for me 12, 13, 14 years ago. You know, when I started to put together a loosely organized picture of the problems with school, I had obviously been a student. I had been a teacher. I was working, tutoring kids and doing college consulting at the time. So I had a lot of questions. And the way I was going about getting information and putting this collage together was to say, okay, who else is criticizing school? And I wasn't so quick back then to ask why.
Sure.
You know, so I was also really influenced and still am pretty influenced by, you know, the Mises people like Murray Rothbard, and they're, you know, through and through anarcho-capitalists. Mm-hmm. When I started the show, remembering the broader picture and the original influences that I had, I tried to distill and kind of take from everybody, even though the show, because we talk about a lot of political issues and social issues as well, has mm-hmm. more of a libertarian presentation. I am trying to not just forget the progressive educators, because I think they have a lot of valuable things to say. And I think I took people's word for it. about Dewey. Like, I first encountered Dewey, obviously, when I was either training to be a teacher, like to get certified to be a teacher, or mm-hmm. when I was in graduate school. And when I encountered a message years later that was negative, I think, because I left graduate school, I left that process feeling unsatisfied in a lot of ways. I didn't feel mm-hmm. like we were really treated like adults going through that process. And this was, I was in a classroom with a lot of people who were actively teaching in Massachusetts and New York. But it was a sour experience for me. And when I found something that was counter to, you know, people like Mann and Dewey almost as religious figures, I over-enthusiastically embraced it without really digging into Dewey's work for myself. And it wasn't until I had been doing the show for a couple of years that I started to take a closer look at Dewey. I understand why people who would be more conservative or traditionalist or people who saw value in the original drill and kill, really subject-oriented treatment of education, you know, I mean, they really villainize him. There are people who credit him with making the country illiterate, but I think that's a misreading of his work. And I think it's something that, you know, we would both agree with. One of the important takeaways from Dewey's work, especially his later work in the 1930s, was education is social.
Yes.
I think what people really latched onto was Dewey talked about de-emphasizing reading and specific subjects at a young age to prioritize people acclimating to a community, to belonging, to socializing. Then there would be time for those things later. I think the misreading was Dewey thought there would be time for those things never, or was discouraging reading, and that's not the case. Yeah, I started out pretty misinformed about him. I mean, obviously, whatever I got in college was just a surface skim of his work. And he's obviously part of the pantheon of, you know, school, the people mm-hmm. who shaped schools in the 20th century.
Sure.
But yeah, OK, so that's a foundation right there. Can I ask what made you? Well, first of all, we should talk a little bit more about your background. You started teaching not too long ago, just like five or 6 years ago, right?
Yeah. I've only been teaching for 5 years. I'm a high school social studies teacher, and I'm pretty fortunate. I wouldn't necessarily call it a progressive school, but it's a school where teachers have almost complete autonomy. Mm-hmm. So I can almost do whatever I want, which means I can explore a lot of different things. So when I first started teaching, I was an incredibly traditional teacher. I mean, as you just said, I went through a grad program. And when I went through my grad program, I don't want to sound cocky, but I felt like I was like the top of my class. I felt like I was really good at it. I mean, I got an amazing GPA. Like, I really understood how to do a great lesson plan. I used to make like 13, 14 page lesson plans. I was the kind of guy that went home after work and just planned and graded for 5 or 6 hours. Mm-hmm. And I'd go to bed and wake up the next morning. And I was like, okay, here we go. But anyways, after about really a year of doing that and wanting to kill myself, I went into one of my friend's classrooms, and she was teaching. She's a science teacher. She was talking about the Industrial Revolution, which as a history teacher is a month to 2 months worth of content in a traditional sense. And maybe one kid knew what it was, like, let alone anything specific about it, like what it was, the concept of the Industrial Revolution. And this was after I just spent all of that time signing all these things and having tests over it. And I was very confused about that. And I basically had like an existential crisis where I was like, well, what's the purpose of me doing any of this work? Because the whole reason why I became a teacher was I wanted to help people. I wanted to actually educate. And what does that mean? And ironically, we read a lot of Paulo Freire and John Dewey when I was in grad school. However, that was the same place where I also learned how to do all these traditional things. And I went back and I referenced a lot of that stuff, and I started to realize that, you know, child development research and pretty much any research that's not in the realm of standardized testing supports the views of progressive education. They support ideas of focusing on skills over content and recognizing that a kid has to choose what it is that they want to do. They have to have some kind of self-direction. It can't just all be top down. So I basically redid all of my classes. I walked in like January of my second year teaching and said, okay, you guys are going to make the class now. Here's what we're going to do. And they did it, and it was incredible, and I loved it, and I just completely changed everything that it was I was doing. It made my life a lot better. So that was kind of my first foray into that field, which quickly escalated into a lot of different things.
Yeah, so 10 years prior, I was having the exact same experience of trying to be a good teacher. Now, I was in a boarding school, but I had taken a teaching job miles away from the rest of the school. I had this specialized campus. I was the lead teacher. I was like 23, 24 years old. And I, it was a really difficult place to work. Nobody cared about anything I did. I think I was telling my guest in the last show that I would ask for permission to do things as the person in charge of education there. And they would say, no, don't rock the boat. And eventually I just learned to start doing whatever I wanted, go to them a month later and say, oh, a month ago I started doing this. It's going really well. They'd say, oh, okay, well, I guess you should keep doing it then. It was just totally status quo, no investment from the administrators. It was a really difficult population of kids, and most people were happy if they were just away from the main campus at this boarding school. Yeah, it was after the first year of teaching. You know, it was half a pot of coffee in the morning and a bottle of Jim Beam at night, and it was just day in and day out, and there was no way I could have maintained it another year. And I wound up just abandoning the books, abandoning what being a good teacher meant. I kind of confronted the administration with the support of a psychologist, and we did more of an experiential learning and life skills style curriculum, and it was a huge success.
Yeah.
The problem was when I left, no one really wanted to maintain that because it was a lot of work. It was probably more hours and more thought than the first year, but it was like way less stress. And maybe you found something similar. I wanted to invest my time. I wanted to invest that energy. I didn't mind being there on a Saturday to set things up for something that everybody was enjoying. Everybody was clearly getting value out of. But when I left, being just the most enthusiastic person about this whole project and kind of having ownership over it, it certainly doesn't mean nobody else could have done it. Nobody else wanted to do it at that time, and it fell apart. And I think it's a transition here to a difficult question about what impact, like if more and more people working in positions like the one you work in, right, or working just working in public school generally, embrace these ideas, what impact do you think it could have on this very inhuman system that everybody is subjected to?
I mean, it's an interesting question because, I mean, there are progressive schools that exist that have had pretty substantial effects on their local communities, like Sudbury schools, for example.
Sure.
And I mean, I feel that school should be a communal place that the community actually is involved with. One thing our school honestly doesn't do very well is inviting the community in and actually giving them say in what the kids are doing, or at least having connections that are authentic. I would imagine that the more teachers that adopt this type of pedagogy, the more parents and kids actually would be on board with it. I mean, I've had conversations with a lot of concerned parents. Like, for example, on my syllabus, it says that the kid automatically gets an A. And here's all the things that we might cover, but we might not, depending on what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And for some parents, that's like, well, that's not class rank. You're not going to prepare them for the standardized test. You're not going to do, you know, so on and so forth. But after having conversations with those parents in more detail and explaining them about what I'm doing, I've never had someone tell me, like, that's not a good idea. Because it's an innate human quality that if you're trying to inspire curiosity and creativity and actually caring about the person, and they see that, then they're like, oh, well, why aren't more teachers doing that? I was like, well, good question. Because that's what people don't expect anymore. They expect it to be for the standardized test. So I think that it would actually have a very positive effect in terms of how the community would see these ideas.
Okay, so there might be like a tipping point, right? Where if it reached enough critical mass of teachers doing this. Yeah, I mean, obviously, my show has staked out its position on school, right?
Yeah, sure.
But it doesn't mean that I get any kind of gratification from the fact that millions of children suffer or don't get their needs met in these settings. I gave up on the idea of reform personally at the beginning, but obviously, I'm encouraged to hear about anything that is being more thoughtful and more caring in that environment. So, you know, I'm still, it's difficult to have any conception for me of how the current system could deliver the results, so many of the results that I think we both find desirable, or and even like, let's not even talk about results, the settings, yeah. You know, the interactions, yeah, yeah. The relationships that we find desirable.
From a planning point of view, one thing that we honestly get in a lot of hot water for, maybe on social media with the Human Restoration Project, is personally, I support kids making any choice they want to. So like, we ally with unschoolers or homeschoolers or whatever it is that someone wants to do. I personally think that there should be a choice between whatever it is that you want to do. Like, you can't have progressive schools that everyone's forced to go to. That goes against the entire point of what a progressive school is.
Right.
It's just ensuring that the schools that exist, if they are more traditional, transition to more of a progressive approach while still maintaining those other choices. Like, I'm highly encouraged by like Deborah Meyer's work with small schools and converting schools into being schools within schools, where they all are like micro managed and they all have like their own sets and their school choice between different publicly funded schools that you don't have to pay, you know, an arm and a leg for in order to get a quality education, at least quality in terms of like you're actually cared about.
Right.
In that sense.
Well, I like what you said, too, about, you know, the community focus, where the people who are teaching in the school are people who are invested in the community. Right. It's mm-hmm. I hate to relate it to community policing. I hate to relate mm-hmm. it to community. But the idea that if people have some kind of social or emotional investment in the place where they're doing this work, that could be an improvement in the overall condition of that place.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it has to go hand in hand with just education on this topic in general. I find myself having to explain a lot what it is that I'm talking about, because even though these ideas make sense logically to me, many people went through this system and were, even those that weren't successful within the school system, still believe that getting all A's means that you're really smart or that you have to do things a certain way. And my fear would be, without education, the community would actually come in and demand even more standardized testing or more focus on those things, because they're not seeing the greater picture of like, no, you can actually change the entire system. So it has to go hand in hand also with just ensuring people understand all different perspectives when it comes to building a better education system.
Okay, so let's talk about that being said, let's talk about two levels of pushback and how sure. they've both been addressed. So one you already mentioned, with parents who might not understand what you're doing. And you mentioned the objections that they would raise, like, I'm worried there's not going to be a class rank if there's no report card. And how does this prepare people to take standardized tests? What's been your strategy or the common talking points used to diffuse those kinds of objections to what you're doing?
Well, usually what I do is I focus a lot on talking about what it means to learn. I'm a huge fan of Alfie Cohn, as most progressive educators are. And he usually opens up his conferences with asking the parent, what is it that they want their child to be like when they're 30 or 40? And they always say content, happy, satisfied, maybe married, maybe have children, something like that. But they rarely mention, you know, they had a really high GPA or they have like a really well-paying job. They don't usually focus a lot on the things that schools say that should be the focus. So first, I frame it in the sense of ensuring that I'm talking about their emotional well-being, their child being satisfied with their lives, and then going through and explaining to them how traditional school actually diminishes those practices. So I talk a lot about the research that informs and says that right now you're rank and filed. And even if you do really well, even if you're at the top of your class, those people actually have even greater social and emotional low-being scores, like they're as in they're lower. I mean, to the point of being suicidal, really serious, serious problems. And then I also explain to them the concepts of what experiential learning or more student voice in the classroom actually looks like in terms of inspiring leadership and creativity and curiosity and restoring that love of learning that existed when the kid was likely in kindergarten, when everyone's hands went up, you know, and everybody wanted to learn more about just random crap, which doesn't exist anymore by the time they're a freshman in high school. I mean, a lot of my work is with deprogramming kids, like getting kids to actually believe that I'm not lying about like, right. like you know, you actually have an A. And there'll be many times it's like, so why do I have an A in this class? And it's like March. I'm like, yes, I've been explaining this now for months. Like, it's not a trick. Like, there's not going to be a time where it's like, I've passed kids that don't do anything. It's happened. It doesn't happen very often because most kids eventually choose to do something, but there are, you know, a handful of kids every year that legitimately do nothing. And I'll talk to them and try to, you know, get to know them a little bit better, but I'm not going to fail them. I just don't agree with that practice. So explaining to the parents why it is that I'm doing it in terms of the humanity element of it and showing them the research that supports it because it's overwhelming, usually converts them over to believing that philosophy.
So you get some buy-in from the parents, let's say, at that level. Obviously, you have buy-in from fellow educators, you have buy-in at the student level, and here there's more of a community, like where people have pretty unified interests, parents to teachers to students. What if at level two we have to talk about administrative objections, which progressive educators or people trying to implement this inside public schools or even maybe some charter schools or some private schools, they must have encountered this.
Yeah. I guess there's two different ways. One would be also Deborah Meyer came up with the idea or explained the idea of creative noncompliance, which is something that I am definitely guilty of. The idea of like you just say one thing and do another, which is kind of like what you were getting at before.
Yes.
It's like, oh, I had no idea that I was doing this incorrectly. Let me change it, but you don't actually change it. And also in Jonathan Kozol's work as well, the idea of if you do things really well and you get fired, if you have support of the community, you're not going to get fired. Or if you do, someone's going to help you. Someone's going to come to your defense. I think that's in Savage Inequalities. He talks about the idea of building a coalition of people that will support you. So that would be one thing. One thing is just being a rebel against the system and wishing that things would be better and just doing the best you can within your own little microcosm. And I also talk a lot about teaching to be fired. The idea of if you're in this profession to do it this way, why would you give up the entire purpose of doing it just to keep your job? Like, in my opinion, if I got fired tomorrow because people didn't like what I was doing, I could just go get another job. Teachers don't get paid that much money. I'll just go do something else until I find a job that's going to do what I want it to do. And that might be kind of a scary thing because it's that loss of that safety net. But again, I didn't do this job because I wanted to do this traditional style of teaching. It's not worth it for me. So I'll just keep doing it. The second thing, though, at like a bigger level of convincing administrators that could change the entire philosophy of the school is, I think the same way that we do anything within a democracy, which is hopefully banding teachers together and demanding that change, getting everyone on board and recognizing this research, compiling it together and showing administrators not only does progressive education instill more human values, but it also actually does raise standardized test scores. I don't like it being a mask, like a masquerade for like I don't do this because it raises standardized test scores. It's not the purpose, but it does. So at the same time, if that's something that you're hyper concerned with, you can point to the research and say, not only is it good for progressive education, it's actually good for traditional education as well. So if they're someone who's more detached and someone who's kind of completely focused on this gross style of education that exists, you can convince them that way as well.
Right. And to that objection, as far as the delivery of some foundational skills that are the base of a learner being able to go out and explore, like you can't do this if you don't know how to read, let's say, just as an example, right? You can't engage in this exploration if you can't read the material that, you know, Google's returning to you. Or you can you even Google? How does that work as far as foundational skills are concerned?
So in my class, we typically design pretty grandiose project-based learning experiences. So like, for example, next year we're talking about doing a full year long with all of our classes actually of building spaceships, like model spaceships. A key facet being that you don't have to do that. So I think a lot of progressive educators go wrong by saying PBL is like you take an activity and have everyone do it and they learn that way. That's not what it is. Instead, it's you design an experience that you hope the majority of students will have buy-in with, and then you model that behavior and discuss with them how to do it. And along the way, they're going to get all those foundational skills because, as you just said, I can't build a model spaceship without reading how to build a model spaceship. You're going to need to read at some point. And if you can't figure it out, my goal would be, okay, then someone in the room helps you. And if it's not me, then it's another student, which would be ideal, because that'd be really cool to have the community come together and work towards a common goal. Now, for the students that aren't interested in that, the goal is to figure out, well, what is it that you're interested in, which at the high school level can be quite difficult. A lot of kids are completely disengaged to the point of being completely apathetic towards learning anything at all, even if it benefits like their future, whatever it is they want to do. Right. And that just is a lot of conversations about, well, how do we get there? And I personally think that you'll naturally learn how to read and do those things if you're given the time and opportunity to do so. I don't think you have to force them to do it. If you give a kid 8 hours and say, okay,
like, we're going to do some things. What do you need help with? Eventually, a kid's going to come to the point where they're going to read or learn basic math, because those are things that you do every single day. I couldn't imagine going through the entire system without learning how to do that if you're given the time to do so.
Now, you're teaching high school. Is that age range 14 to, you know, up to 17, senior, freshman to senior?
I teach mostly freshmen. So the way our school's set up, we just actually opened a middle school relatively recently. So they're 7th and 8th. I see most students in 9, 10, and then 11, 12 is mostly a college experience. We're part with a local community college, and students get 2 years of that community college for free through our institution, which actually is a really weird situation to be in, because even though many of our teachers are pushing for experiential ed, by the time the kids get to 11th and 12th grade, it's still very traditional. So we're actually exploring different options to potentially have that be an option rather than a forced thing that all kids do. But most of my kids are 9th and 10th.
Okay. The reason why I ask is I wanted to get your wisdom about this. One of the things that we obviously taught, there's lots of people in my audience, and this comes up a lot on the show, is people have children who are in school and they wind up mm-hmm. taking their children, or their children want to leave school, and the parents facilitate this into yep. some kind of an unschooling environment. Obviously, there's a de-schooling or decompression period mm-hmm. For them. I also think about my experience as a teacher. It's funny, this did not happen when I did a complete 180 from the 2002-2003 school year to the 2003-2004 mm-hmm. school year, where I went from lockdown the first year, yeah. this is what I was describing, to a completely open project-based learning environment the second year. That actually seemed pretty seamless. But when mm-hmm. I took the lessons of that and the spirit of that to my next teaching job, which was teaching history to high yep. school students in another private school, they had never really encountered anybody like that mm-hmm. before. Anybody who wanted to have that approach. Anyone who wanted to do a ceremony at the beginning of the year where they took the pile of textbooks off the shelf and locked them in the supply closet in front of everybody. I thought yeah. it was very cool. That was a challenge. And do you find that, you know, you're getting these high schoolers? This is obviously alien, this way of learning. How do you address that?
It depends. I mean, I feel like you could never master that skill, especially when we didn't have a middle school, which was only last year. Getting students that come from our schools located in an area where it's incredibly traditional. Most of our kids come from county schools out in the middle of nowhere. And no offense to county schools, but they tend to be rather traditional. I mean, kids come to me and they tell me that like their teachers used to hit them like across the hand still, like that level of education.
Wow.
They come to me and I'm in there trying to be like Robin Williams or something. Like I'm waiting for like my moment where it's like, oh man, I finally got them. It doesn't always happen.
Right.
For some of my kids, they take off with this stuff, especially students that are typically labeled as being different. Some of them are like on IEPs, maybe they have autism or, you know, something where it's they just didn't do well sitting still. Those kids do incredible right away. And then the students who maybe were at the B or C range, they tend to do really, really well. The students that struggle are the students that didn't care to begin with, and now they're being told, well, now you really don't have to do anything. That's a hard sell to them. And it takes a lot of convincing. And students that get all A's because you're telling them that their achievements potentially aren't as important as they make them out to be. And I'm not saying that it isn't important to achieve academically. I mean, it is if you want it to be. But we do spend a lot of time talking about how it's not the end all be all. And there's actually a lot of problems with being perfect in all areas and what that means. It means you're very compliant in the traditional system.
Sure.
So talking to both ends of that spectrum takes a lot of explaining what it is that I'm doing to the point of like, it sometimes almost feels narcissistic at times, as in I feel like I'm just talking about how great my own class is because I just keep talking about the pedagogy behind it. And I think it probably gets annoying, but I feel like kids need a lot of time to adjust because they don't know what it is you're trying to do. I mean, if you're raised in the system, you think that is the system, so you're not going to question it. So it's a lot of like meta discussions.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you're involving students in that process. A few episodes back, and you kind of just hinted at this on your podcast, you did a show about savior complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know if you were speaking from some personal experience, because I listened to that show. I drank the podcast like over the last couple of days. I just drank your podcast out of a fire hose. but I remember listening to that one. It really resonated with me because that was a big part of why I got into teaching, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't really think about what it was going to mean or how I was going to do things differently. Like you mentioned a few minutes ago that you weren't interested in the traditional style of, you know, education or schooling. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that far ahead. You know, being a teacher was a noble profession. I felt, since I graduated from college, with like a sense of duty to go and serve. I had lots of lofty conceptions of what I was doing at the time. But it is a challenge for educators when you feel like you're doing something differently and you feel like you're breaking the mold and you feel like you're being rebellious. Yeah, there is a kind of narcissism, for lack of a better word, that can pollute your thinking a little bit. Definitely dealt with that at all steps of my career because I was telling myself this story that I think was true, you know, that I would just learn my way out of doing one job after another. I would find all the flaws. I would find all the reasons why it was wrong, why it wasn't serving the kids. And then I would sort of, you know, take this hot air balloon ride in my own head to whatever the next job was that I had outgrown or was too good to do that kind of work anymore, eventually, until I just wound up sitting in front of this microphone without a job at all. So, I'd like to hear you speak about that a little bit, because obviously there was a motivation behind that show, the savior complex.
Yeah. So, I mean, personally, I went through like three phases in education. I personally wanted to be a teacher going out of high school because I hated high school.
Yeah.
I did not do well. I did well academically, but in terms of my actual, like, if you were to see me as a student, you'd be like, this kid's like not going to do anything. I was to the point of truancy 2 years in a row, my ninth and 10th grade or eighth and ninth grade year. And I just kind of phoned it in because I knew how to play the system. And I actually thought history was fascinating. I loved studying those topics, especially politics. And I thought, man, I can do things a lot better and not be such a dick about it. Because my coaches, like I had coaches as all my AP history teachers, and they were all just so cruel and mean and gross. And I just didn't enjoy it. So my first phase of education was like, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to be really nice and I'm going to be really cool. And then I went to grad school, got way more traditional because that's what I thought good teaching was. And then my third phase was realizing I was a little bit more rebellious and I was just going to be like, well, I'm just going to screw the entire system over and work my way from the inside and see what happens. So that savior complex thing is something that's always really bothered me in education. Just the idea that one, they're obviously to save everyone, but also just this teachers are superheroes, or like that somehow teachers are noble to the point where they're untouchable. And that's something that always really bothered me because in a career that demands respect, all careers that demand respect have people that criticize them. You're not immune from criticism to the point where you are respected. And I understand that teachers don't make as much as they should, and they're often the subject of kind of disparagement, but that doesn't mean that you can't critique that profession or somehow it's better than other professions or else like the hardest job, etc. And I'm always really bothered by the people that, I mean, I've been insulted, I guess, online, people saying like, you can't criticize teachers or you can't say this because teachers work really hard. I was like, well, no shit, they work really hard. I'm a teacher. I know they work really hard, but lawyers work really hard too. And they get criticized all the time. So like it's perfectly okay to not be the person who is like reaching down to like the huddled masses and raising them all up from this horrible predicament that they're in. Instead, it's perfectly fine to be the person that recognizes like, oh, they're all people and I'm going to work with them to hopefully make them a little bit better. It's not as insane as it makes it out to be. Plus, not to mention, at least it's so much stress to think that like you're in there and somehow going to make all of them have a 180 degree change from where they were. It's impossible. And I think that is adding way too much unneeded stress to the average teacher that thinks that's what's expected of them.
It's a good point. There's so much conflation, right? Because I first noticed this actually with like U.S. foreign policy and the military. And the two are very, like, as far as teaching is concerned, this is a loose relation. I get it. Mm-hmm. But if people criticized, you know, the United States going to war in Iraq or Afghanistan, I remember that a completely fair response, apparently, 10, 12 years ago was, yeah, but you got to support the troops. And I noticed it was actually there was this same kind of protection of education, that the teachers were almost being used as a shield I mean, teaching is so, just public education in general is so politicized that mm-hmm. back in 2011, there was pretty significant controversy. I think it was centered in Wisconsin and it spread to a few states. West Virginia recently dealt with this with a teacher strike, mm-hmm. where people are immediately in their battle stations as soon as it's a public education issue. Sure. And the defense is always to put the teachers out. And one of the things that really rubbed me the wrong way at the time is that the teachers were dragging the students out in front of the teachers. So you have the students are the front line in this war, then the teachers, and then the actual system behind it. That rankled me pretty good 7 or 8 years ago. But you have the same problem the other way, where people forget that there are so many people like those who would take an interest in what you're doing at the Human Restoration Project mm-hmm. working in these schools every day. All of us went into that career highly motivated and highly enthusiastic, even if we were confused about, you know, what kind of educators we wanted to be or why. Mm-hmm. But those people, because of the politicization, they also get cast aside or criticized unfairly by the other side.
I mean, my overall goal is that I would hope in our age of information, if you will, like being able to access the internet and go on social media, that more progressive educators keep doing what they're doing. Because I mean, a lot of my friends that became teachers, they quit. Like they were like, screw this, it's not worth it, mm-hmm. because they were of that mindset. And I think that just seeing that other people are the same way that you are outside of reading it in a book is a really powerful thing. Like I see videos of people on Twitter talking about the same exact things that I'm talking about. And that matters a lot to me because I feel like I'm not alone. Because before when I first started doing it, I was like, I thought I was going to get fired the next day because I read in a book that you should do this. And I just assumed that that was the best thing to do. Whereas if I see other people doing it, I'm like, oh, it's not crazy. Especially considering that when a lot of people hear of progressive education, they assume that it's bad teaching because it doesn't look like the quote unquote perfect classroom. Like if you say that you're not going to give grades, or you say that like kids are going to be running around and doing what they want, that automatically escalates into, well, you're not teaching anything and kids are like running through the school, which is not what it means. It doesn't go that far. It never would. So a lot of it is too recognizing that what is good is bad and what is bad is good.
Okay, so I think maybe the difference is as far as the suspicion about progressive education in schools, in public schools, let's say, would mm-hmm. be the level of investment of the supervisors. Now, who are the sure. supervisors, right? In progressive yeah. education in schools, it's the teachers maybe acting against the desires or the policies of administrators some mm-hmm. or a lot of the time. But in other environments like unschooling or home education environments, it's the parents who yeah. are overseeing this. So I think there's a lot of people in my audience who are more comfortable with it in that sense, right? Or yeah, in that setting, that. I should say,
yeah.
Because it's obviously it's just a drastically different relationship. And sure, mm-hmm. there's plenty of teachers who care, but when parents are allowing their own children the self-directed mode of learning, I think a lot of people, I would believe, and I think a lot of people in the audience would believe, that any sort of unintended consequences of implementing something like that, they might persist a lot longer in a school where mm. there's less of an incentive structure than there would be in a home.
Sure. Yeah. I take all this with like a grain of salt because personally, I believe that you should have the choice no matter what.
Right.
So I think that for some students, of course, it would make more sense to go the unschooling approach. I don't think that school should be forcing every single person to come to the exact same classrooms to do the exact same thing. Because if you're going to abolish standardization, you also have to have a consensual relationship between the school and the student. I think the place for progressive education is that there is a free public place that kids can go to, that everyone has access to, where students can work as a community in order to do what it is that they want to do as a community. Essentially, it's very similar to programs that already exist, honestly, in the like homeschooling community. It's just more formalized, and teachers will be trained. And I hate this term because it's used in a really gross way in traditional education, but the guide on the side approach, not guide on the side in the sense of like, oh, I'm going to get them to do their standards done because I'm the guide on the side. A guide on the side in the sense that there's a trained professional there who has an education degree, who can help your kid get to what they want to do. Because I think it's a lot to expect, especially for parents that maybe don't have the income to just be staying at home or, you know, paying for maybe more expensive programs. It would be good for to have a place where someone could be there to help their children learn.
Do you guys ever talk about something that's coming up a lot in the last couple of years, definitely on my show? Toxic outside influences. Like, obviously, attention spans are shortening, you know?
Yeah.
Mine is. I'll admit it. These kids who, you know, maybe they have high sugar diets or certainly high stimulus environments outside of school, asking them to for this attention and discipline and self-responsibility, it might be a difficult proposition for a lot of them, given the way their lives work outside of school. I mean, I remember I was dealing with this in a day school in 2006, and you know, so the height of stimulation outside of school, aside from, you know, drinking and drugs and sex, was the Chappelle Show, right?
Yeah.
The Chappelle Show. They would come in and they would quote the Chappelle Show, and I'd have to redirect them. You can't say that word in school, et cetera, et cetera. But today, it's that times a million.
Yeah.
You know, that would just create a new challenge. And I've been out of that environment to know too long how that's affecting you guys.
Personally, in my classroom, I don't ban anything. So like, kids can be on their cell phones if they want to be. They can, our school issues one-to-one laptops. So all students have a laptop, as well as kids have almost free reign, as in like they can go to the bathroom and back. I don't let kids like leave for like an hour, obviously, because I could get in a lot of trouble. But there are like just basic things that I think humans should be able to do, as in they make that choice. I personally think that if you don't allow for those things in the classroom, you're just setting up a situation where the kid is only going to be trained that they shouldn't do those things when the adult is in the room. Whereas I would rather have it be a kid realizes what they're doing is important, and therefore they self-regulate themselves towards that behavior. And for some, that's more difficult than others, but I'm not comfortable with the idea of saying like, okay, everybody put your phones away, we're going to do this now. And saying that that is going to teach them the skills that they need in order to be successful.
Of course.
Yeah. And kind of like in that same vein too, I think that it's kind of a negative view of humanity to think that a person is not capable of recognizing what's important to them to the point where they're going to be so absorbed within a screen or the things going on around them that they're just not going to pay attention to it. Now, to an extent, yes, of course, kids are going to be more focused on things that matter to them when they're a teenager. But I also think school should shift to things that matter to them as a teenager, because that would be the thing that they choose to do. So not everything has to be the next step. Like, we don't have to be training every single kid at every single point to do college or occupation based work.
Yeah. And I think I'm applying that question to a norm where a lot of young people, like the people your students age, lack perspective because they've never been asked to have perspective.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And they've never been asked. And this is another important thing that comes up on your show again and again. They've never been asked to contemplate or develop or begin the pursuit of some kind of purpose.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. That is the very first thing that appears like on our website, because that to me just boggles the mind. I don't understand the concept of going through all of your developmental years, never spending, let alone a majority, even a minority of your time focused on purpose and what it is that you want to be. Not necessarily your occupation, just what is it that you want out of life? Like, who are you as a person? I don't understand why we're not spending 80, 90% of our time focused on that exact question, because I'm finding every single year we talk about this stuff all the time in my class, and the vast majority of my kids have absolutely no idea. Like, they don't even have – I have kids that Google that question, which they actually Google, like, what's a good purpose in life? That to me is so foreign, and it scares me, actually. It scares me because I think that we're developing a society of people that are completely apathetic towards their own lives. And I think that you're going to start to see – I mean, we've already seen circumstances where people are no longer getting involved politically. They're no longer getting as involved in like their communities or social organizations, and they don't question anymore the things that it is that they're doing. They're doing kind of like the initial goals of education, which is they're just obeying the person at the top.
Right.
I just can't understand how someone could actually walk into a classroom and say, my work is more important than your purpose of being a person.
Well, first of all, this speaks to why I named the show School Sucks, because mm-hmm. I was observing, you know, you mentioned four or five-year-olds, like preschoolers being curious, putting their hands up, wanting to ask a lot of why questions. I had nieces and nephews that age at the time that I was finishing up my tutoring career, working with Ivy League bound varsity athletes who had trouble making eye contact and had trouble not mumbling when they talked and had trouble sounding enthusiastic or optimistic or excited about anything going on in their lives, even though by, you know, the popular metrics, they were destined for success, you know?
Yeah.
And contrast that to 4 or 5-year-olds in my family who couldn't do anything. You know, they couldn't even keep boogers off their clothes, but they were super excited about everything in life, about themselves, about what they could do, you know, their new capacities. They were curious. They were individualistic. And I said, well, you know, what lies between these two groups is 15,000 hours of compulsory schooling. Yeah. And in that time, while those natural gifts are sucked out of people, the installation is these 3 hidden lessons. And this is what we were just talking about. And I think it starts to get to the answer to that question. Why is there no purpose? You know, the lesson one is obedience.
Yeah.
I don't remember a lot of because I say so's. I don't remember a lot of times where somebody held a ruler up over their head threatening to rap my knuckles with it. But it was persistent, right? It was subtle but persistent throughout that entire experience. School also requires lesson two, which is conformity. Take that self-responsibility away through obey and conform, repeated demands to obey and conform, you wind up with young adults who are lesson three, very apathetic, right? Yeah. Politically, socially, philosophically, culturally, they're ready to be written on. And I think that if we go back and we look at the original purposes of school, you know, from the 19th century attitudes towards immigrants coming to this country from Europe to the assessments of the Rockefeller Education Board at the beginning of the 20th century to the political, social, and commercial influence of people like Edward Bernays, right up to the management of political messaging today, how everything has to be kind of bland and safe because we don't want people to think like this or we don't want people to freak out like that. There doesn't seem to be the presence of a lot of belief that the public is rational, right? Yeah. So obviously there school is scientific and social management, and people are still going through school being handed scripts, you know? Yeah. Maybe there's a few versions of this script based on backgrounds and aptitudes and maybe even interests, but the idea of unrestricted self-direction is terrifying to any large-scale system of management. I think that's the reason why we see so many people so purposeless, because there's no encouragement of it ever, because I think a lot of powerful people have felt for a long time that they can't afford that. That's a very dangerous thing. I know I sound like somebody from the John Birch Society right now saying stuff like this. I know this is very cynical. But these people wrote this. They wrote a lot of this stuff down in one form or another to serve a variety of interests, you know, whether it was about creating some kind of utopian political system or industrial system.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's very cyclical in nature, as in I don't think like the average teacher walks into the room thinking that they are there to control their kids.
Of course not.
They just think that they're going in there to do the job that was their good teacher when they were in school. I mean, the majority of teachers do very well academically and want to do the exact same thing that their favorite teacher did when they were in school, which makes a lot of sense. The problem is that if you never question the why of what it is that you're doing, you just perpetuate the system that's already there.
Right.
There are a lot of very powerful forces that want to ensure that you do have a very uniform workforce. And one thing that scares me about even modern educators that claim to be progressive is that they're still framing it around like we want people to be able to work at Google. Progressive education is not like
taking your social studies class and making it a coding class. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, framing everything around what a tech company needs in terms of like their soft skills, like creativity. That's not it. The point is to dismantle that structure so that the actual classroom looks and feels differently. It's not different subjects.
Right. And mm-hmm. it can be a time of exploration and also a time of realizations of intrinsically motivated triumphs.
Yes.
You know, and yes. then, you know, the last show I did earlier this week, I talked to a gentleman who is a graduate. And I don't even know if they call them graduates, but of this program, Praxis. Have you heard of Praxis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, after somebody goes through an environment like that, whether it's a formal school or not, maybe that's the next step, right? Maybe that's yeah. where the coding begins. But it doesn't have to be Killer Mike's comical conception of schooling.
Yeah, if you're motivated to do it, it would make sense that you would go out and do those things. Like I sat through a lot of very traditional classes in college that I honestly loved because it was a thing that I chose to do and I was interested in it. And that's also like another misconception of progressive ed is that people think that you can never lecture in progressive education. Sure, you can. If the kids ask you to lecture, you lecture. I do that sometimes. Kids want me to do it. And they ask me, so I do it. It's not necessarily like step-by-step instructions. You're literally just doing what they tell you to do or they're interested in.
Right, right. So that's a good segue into a final question.
Sure.
Helping young people realize purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Because you must encounter students who've, like we talked about before, they've never been asked to think about this. They've never encountered this kind of openness or freedom before. What are some steps or some parts of that process where, you know, young people encountering this idea for the first time, I would say way later in life, even if they're 13 or 14 years old, they're being asked to think about it for the first time. How does that process begin and how are they encouraged to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually something I've been focusing a lot on my own podcast in terms of talking to people. Like we were talking to Aaron Robb, who's a graduate of Stanford, who does work in re-envisioned ed in terms of purpose building, Kendall Cottenbronk, who is a premier researcher on the subject, William Damon as well. All these people that they're child development or some form of development expert when it comes to facilitating purpose. And as far as what they've said, and as well as what I've found, the simplest thing is actually just to ask about it, as in, you walk into your classroom and you have a one-on-one conversation with a kid about where they want to see themselves when they're 30 and describing that process to you in an extended conversation that goes beyond one sentence. You give them purposeful time and you just sit down together and you say, hey, we're going to talk about this for a bit. Is that cool? And they're usually okay because it's an interesting topic to talk about. And they come to a lot of realizations just by thinking about it for a second. And that sounds really, really simple. Mm-hmm. I realize that's like, that sounds so just like canned, but it's true. Like that's what it is. And we also do work with, I always plug them, but I feel like I'm a shill for them. Mm. But Project Wayfinder is an organization that we started working with who's based out of Stanford, and they've developed like a set of activities based around answering that question of what purpose is. And I personally found that most kids, again, are into it because you're just talking about who they are. Like questions like, what are things that you enjoy doing? How could you apply those things with other things? What is it that you do for fun and what does that mean? Like we have a lot of conversations about kids that like to play sports. You'll hear all the time like they want to play sports. It's their only interest. They love sports. But then when you really talk to them about it, it's not the sport that they love. It's being involved with teammates and working together, being a leader and commanding other people and telling them what to do, that kind of stuff. It's not necessarily the sport itself. So diving deep into those students' personal lives and figuring out what it is that makes them tick and having almost like a guidance counselor style relationship with them, where you're walking them through potential avenues for them to explore. And I think the one thing that progressive educators want to instill that maybe is a divisive point from maybe like a completely homeschooled environment is presenting ideas to students that could be potential things that they could do. So more focused on exposure. And I recognize that many people do that, but I don't think it's always the case, as in like there's like the MOOC style of like do this, and then you'll figure it out on your own. I think progressive educators tend to do more of like do this, and I'm going to introduce to you new things that you might want to do.
I think there'd be a lot of overlap there. Like deciding I'm going to take an online course or that I need an apprentice is a self-directed act, right? It's a self-directed decision. It might just be the next step. But I like what you said about, you know, bringing that into the open, because at that point, in that student-teacher relationship or student-mentor relationship, you have this kind of scope. Yeah. You have a starting point in that scope, and you can zoom out to generalization, like you were talking about. Like, these are the properties of this thing, right? Right now that you call football. Mm-hmm. If you scope out, then you can say, all right, time with friends, you know, all of these things that would allow them to move laterally, maybe into other activities that satisfy those same general needs. But you could also scope in and create opportunities for them to work on the specifics, the fundamentals, the skills of that thing. But you've identified that thing. Maybe the zoom in brings, you know, satisfaction and achievement, but maybe the zoom out broadens horizons and leads them to something new that, like, oh, maybe this is the thing. I mean, that certainly happened to me.
Yeah. I can give you like as of like 2 weeks ago, I was talking with a girl who, to be stereotypical, is like the cheerleader of the group. She's literally a head cheerleader. And we have a D&D club at our school that I lead. And I saw her and I was like, you know, I honestly think you would really like this. It's completely outside of the ballpark, but she loves like just like talking to people about really random things. She likes telling stories, things of that nature. So she joined our D&D group with five people who are the complete antithesis of what she is. Like, just like, you know, people like me in school, like super nerdy, like, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And she loved it because we figured out her main thing that she really loves doing is just creative storytelling and just talking about things that are just like really off the wall and being kind of weird about it. And she found like this weird home inside this group of people that she likely would have never spoken to before. And I think hopefully in further dialogue that will lead her down the opportunity to explore more ways that you can creatively express yourself beyond just cheerleading. I mean, that's one potential way that you could go, but there's a lot of ways that you could develop yourself socially. For example, like we might talk about like nonprofits. Maybe we'll visit a nonprofit and talk about like what they do and how that connects. I feel like the more things that I can expose them to and have them question things for themselves, the better opportunities they'll have in life.
I love it. Man, the D&D cheerleader story is by far my favorite school story of 2019 so far.
Cool. Nice.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. So before we wrap up today, I just wanted to make sure that the people in my audience knew how they can learn more about what you're doing at Human Restoration Project and how they can find you online, like on social media, and how they can find the podcast.
Sure. So, I mean, you can access everything through humanrestorationproject.org, where we just kind of house everything, as well as we're on Twitter at HumeResPro, which is just the first three letters of every word, as well as we're on every podcast player. You can either search Human Restoration Project or Things Fall Apart, which is the title of the podcast.
Chris, thank you so much for the conversation, and let's do it again. We'll find another topic, then we'll go at it.
Sure. Awesome. Thanks so much. Oh, welcome, strangers.